until they recommit. But we ask that they come back and try again, and that's no different than any other segment of parenting that I know of. And when people ask what we do, I say I feel like sometimes it's a giant parenting job. It gives the person a long-term hold on these people, gives the person some criteria to meet, gives an impetus for change, and assists them in finding those coping skills that will keep them safe in our society if they are out. I think probably sometimes the issue is time and money, and I think that given time, you will find that the interdisciplinary action, being able to work with the courts, the mental health, and the correction system, that this will in fact prove to be probably the least economical, or the most economical of any of the systems that we've tried. It certainly does increase our cross-disciplinary action. And I think we should definitely point out that our single biggest problem is the housing in communities when these people are out, and the fear that people have that they will recommit. And I think this system of conditionally releasing is probably one of the best efforts that you can make in keeping people free from mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Richard Sly. I'm an adult parole and probation officer. I work in McFinnville. And I would join my colleagues and Felicia in explaining that I think the board is doing a very adequate job in the concept of protecting the community from folks that come before us. I'd like to point out that in Yamhill County, we have a community corrections program. And why do I mention that? I mention that because I think the PSRB, in placing people on conditional release, as Lois has mentioned, finds itself with a very cost-effective means of placing people in the community. As a parole and probation officer, I'm interested in a lot of the aspects of the files that we review that deal with the person's danger to other people, protection of the community, the rights of the victim, and those kind of concerns. And I think that the board is doing a very good job in addressing those concerns. And I would add that we're in the process of refining a bit of our monitoring system with folks in the community, of conducting checks on driving records and making that information current. And aside from that, there's not a lot that I would add. Happy to answer some questions.
Thank you. First of all, before we take questions, I'll note for the members of the subcommittee that the testimony submitted by the board includes both a section-by-section response to I guess primarily 2075, and then
as well as the amendments to 2075.
And the imposed amendments, and then specific comments addressing the Attorney General's testimony on April 6th. I think it might be more efficient use of our time, given the fact we have several witnesses, not to go into the section by section portion. At this juncture, we can review that for ourselves and then expect to have you here at work session as we go through the proposals section by section and draw on you for comment at that time or responses to questions dealing with your position. Now, I have a couple of questions. As I understand that you are supporting the revision of the form of plea as a board?
Yes, to the guilty. But mentally, yeah.
And your position on the definition of mental disease or defect, do your amendments address that specifically? I don't have the text of the amendments right in front of me now, they're separated. But do you have proposed amendments to achieve that change that you indicated?
I don't have the exact language, but just have the text on the board that we feel basically that you should make a decision whether or not personality is. Your recommendation being that
that exclusion one that can be achieved just by that general reference, or does it need to be more specific?
I think that our view is that people with personality disorders are difficult to treat. I think generally the people at OSH are quite confident that they can bring about changes in that way. So we feel it's great that our work is people that have serious mental illnesses and that have defects of retardation. This is not to say that some of our patients may not have personality disorders in addition to their other conditions. People who just have personality disorders probably cannot be treated thus more economically appropriate to take care of.
In what? In the corrections division?
Representative Myers, that question as to the language is addressed by House Bill 2892. That section of the AG's bill, which in defining mental disease or defect, goes on to state it does not include an abnormality manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct or disorders characterized as personality disorders. Therefore, although we have some concerns regarding the initial portions of the definition submitted by 2892, that particular phraseology would appear to provide the type of definition that would restrict personality disorders from our consideration.
Thank you. As I say, at work session, we'll expect to ask your assistance on the section-by-section analysis as we go through the bills. Further questions of the witnesses at this time? Representative Courtney.
Well, what you're saying about the definition is, it's unclear to me, is that the present definition in law is acceptable, but you want to add in something about the laundry list of what is psychiatric problem. Is that right or wrong? Or do you really, the Attorney General had us, if you will, eliminate this, you know, conforming to the law. And so basically, and I don't know what your feeling is on the present definition of the law in terms of tinkering with that and also adding on this laundry list of personality disorders. So I'm unclear where you're coming from on that.
Representative Courtney, it's our position that we believe that the current definition as it stands, and which is the as currently set forth in the legislation, mm-hmm. is adequate and does not require revision. And for the reasons I stated, we would specifically object to the proposals that were made by the Attorney General in 2892, except for the addition of the phrase that I previously reiterated, which would further restrict it.
And for the committee's information, you have, I don't know what to do as chair of the task force for this reason. We looked at this, and the reason we backed away from the personality disorder is we couldn't get the certified smarts to agree on it. Now, I really mean that. We had, you know, it's like, can you bury nuclear waste safely? You get five physicists on one side say yes, and five would say no. They were all over the place on us, and so we backed away from whether or not we should get into the categories and things, and we just played it safe. It seems to be your testimony, Ms. Snyder, is don't play it safe, run at it, or trust us that you could say your personality disorder is not a mental disease or defect, and which I think is very interesting. It's just that we struggle with that and fight inside, don't mess with it because the psychiatrists have got us all over the place in the hearing.
It's just the basis for our position is because it's been our collective experience that those are the areas in which we have the greatest difficulty.
Okay.
Perhaps the most appropriate arguments can be made that they should be discharged because they're no longer suffering from mental disease or defect. And if you look at the statistics and the report put together by Drs. Manson and Bloom and Mr. Rogers, that is the area in which the psychiatrists and psychologists most disagree. So if you exclude that, we feel that it would not only provide adequately for the protection of the community, those people can, for the most part, be dealt with in the correction system, but also would prevent us from having a lot of problems.
One of the reasons that we think it's important to represent is oftentimes the people with personality disorders, especially antisocial ones, are the most dangerous people that we have. And if we are on shaky ground with the law as to whether we can retain jurisdiction, we're faced with the necessity of sometimes letting them go onto the street when we feel extremely uncomfortable about doing so. We feel making this change will protect us from having to make such a wrong decision. In other words, if a judge or a jury finds somebody's having a mental disease of some kind and dangerous, and that psychiatric testimony consistently does not reveal any major thought disorder or affective disorder, simply a personality disorder. We are unclear under the present law whether we may or may not retain jurisdiction. Cases like that are being appealed in our computer.
Okay. This gets so many people won't testify. If the crime they had committed, this goes along with your amendments, was one of those aggravated bad news things, the problem would take care of itself because they remain under your jurisdiction for the maximum length of the sentence, which we assume would be a whopper sentence. So it takes care of it there. You could conditionally release and monitor the behavior for the length of the sentence. Is that correct? You could.
That's true.
But you must be talking about those individuals who don't commit that serious a crime, but they come under your jurisdiction. You know they're very dangerous, the personality disorder, but
continuous jurisdiction is being proposed in some of the new legislation. It's not part of the law now.
Okay.
I mean, the way it is now, we'd have to let them go.
All right, thank you. Now I'm all set. I feel much better.
I might give another example of what we're talking about. For example, something that has a... We do every once in a while get people that have an alcohol problem and maybe stab someone while they're in an alcoholic stupor and they're put under our jurisdiction. Well, technically they shouldn't. And the law, in fact, now is that they shouldn't be under our jurisdiction. And the testimony of the doctors would be that if they do not have a mental disease or defect. They may be those very dangerous people as long as at any time that they start drinking alcohol. The problem the board has is that kind of a person can be very dangerous if they drink alcohol, but the doctors will testify that's not a mental illness. They don't have a mental illness. They haven't been drinking so much that their brain is fried, but if they drink, they can be very dangerous. The board's put in a position of having to make a decision of discharging a person because they don't have a mental illness under the definition. Or drug dependent might be another, although again, technically under the law, we shouldn't be getting these people. Pedophilia is another example where many doctors will testify that the person that plays around with kids, that's not a mental illness. If the board gets that, they feel, if the board feels very strongly, that person's dangerous and may disagree, in fact, with the testimony of the doctor that whether that is or is not a mental illness.
Representative Hill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many people who have been in your custody and have been released on a short-term or long-term basis while they were out on release have committed crimes?
The best we can give you is the information that was put together, and I believe you got a copy of it last time from Jeff Rogers. And the statistics, okay, table 14 of the information you have that says Oregon's new sanity defense study of the first 5 years, on table 14 it will show you the new charges that were filed against persons while on conditional release. And okay, 15 of 39 persons known to have been found guilty of at least one of a new crime charged against them. 14 others have charges dismissed, which resulted in continued PSW jurisdiction. Five were known to have been found not responsible for new charges and placed again under the jurisdiction of the board for an additional sentence.
That's out of the 690, isn't it?
That's out of 690. We don't have statistics on people that are discharged from the board's jurisdiction. We only have statistics for the follow-up, obviously, of people who do come under our jurisdiction.
Right, so these people were in your custody at the time. Now, what percentage of those were serious felonies?
The original crime or the second crime?
No, the second crime that occurred while they were in your custody.
We have a hijacking. The driving under the influence may not we consider that very dangerous. Anybody that
yes.
has driving on it. There was an assault. Driving while suspended may or may not be dangerous. A rape one. Felony driving while suspended. Driving under influence. Unlawful use of a weapon, which probably is not necessary. And our most serious is a manslaughter, which resulted in a traffic collision.
May I address something on this point? I'm going to interrupt
sure.
Felicia. I was looking over these statistics myself before I came to testify today because I knew that question would come up, and I'm not certain that we have that information that we can give you in terms of a percentage. Perhaps Mr. Rogers, when he testifies today, will be able to elaborate on this. But I was looking through Table 14 in that material, and I noticed that of the various crimes that were committed, only five were found to be not responsible and placed under PSRB jurisdiction as a result of the new crimes. The others were found guilty, which means that they suffered some sanction then under the criminal system. And I think that gets back to what Dr. Klopfer was saying. We have a lot of people who are under our jurisdiction because they're insane, but also have antisocial tendencies, personality disorder, the antisocial behavior. We may be able to say that we've controlled their mental illness, not we, but the hospital.
I understand.
And that they can be adequately controlled in the community from the perspective of having provided treatment for their mental illness. There's nothing that we can do about their antisocial tendencies, about that personality disorder. So from a practical point of view, we may not be able to retain them in the hospital. They may be perfectly appropriate for a conditional release. And yet it's the antisocial tendencies which causes these crimes to occur. And I feel that's why these people have been found guilty in the vast majority of the cases instead of not responsible by reason of insanity, because for the most part, they didn't go insane and commit a crime while they were out on conditional release. It was some other part of their makeup, that antisocial part of it, the criminal tendency which resulted in these crimes being committed. And I don't believe there's any way you can safeguard against that, because those people are going to continue to exist in the community. They're going to continue to recommit crimes.
I mean, once they're out of your custody?
Out of our custody, whether they're on parole or on probation or whatever standard you use, whether you're under a correction system or under the PSRB system, those people ultimately are going to get back in the community, and they ultimately are going to recommit because of that antisocial personality disorder.
Question.
Representative Hill.
Is it safe to say that your track record here is better than what is experienced in corrections?
I think it's quite safe to say that. And in conjunction with that, I was looking over the Attorney General's testimony, and I noticed that, I won't cite to it right now, but he cited a large number of people which have been revoked by us as being an example of recidivism. And the reason that I feel we've got a better track record is because those revocations do not occur as a result of a second crime being committed. They're not an indicator of recidivism. Rather, we revoke people on conditional release when they have missed an appointment to take their medication, missed an appointment with their mental health counselor, not resided for a period even of 24 hours at the place at which they are to reside. I sign about two revocation orders a week on the average, and the vast majority of those are for technical infractions of our conditional release plan, not because they've committed new crimes. And because we have the ability to arrest and to get them back under our jurisdiction very quickly for those what might be considered minor infractions, we can get them reevaluated by the hospital, restabilized if there was some problem with their medication. If nothing else, a little behavior modification. You don't do what we tell you to do, you get your hand slapped. You're going to be back in the institution until we can have a hearing on you. So don't be misled by those statistics which say, oh, we have a lot of revocations. Sure we do, and that's because the system's working.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Excuse me, Representative Hill, I think the point is important on these recommits, that when the judge, they have one chance to come in, and perhaps they do have a mental illness, and the judge puts them under the PSRB, and then they go out and they commit the second crime, and because it's a personality disorder, and they know that they can control the mental illness, I think the statistics prove that the judges say, you know, you are responsible for the crime for which you commit, and then put them into the correction system. So people do have a chance to address the mental illness and the corrections.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you can't treat personality disorders?
Probably not the appropriate one to address that to. I understand that behavior modification therapy is the most frequently used for, like, a sociopathic person. You do something wrong, you get punished. Also, for sex offenders, the Oregon State Hospital does have a sex offenders program, which I understand is highly thought of. And they are treating the sex offenders that we have under our jurisdiction and also those that come from corrections. So I don't think it's fair to draw that type of gross generalization. The sociopath, though, I really think falls into a completely different category.
Yes, I agree. I think that some people with personality disorders can have their behavior changed as a result of rigorous training. However, we consider them responsible for their actions, which is the reason why we favor excluding them. Because I think that if somebody has personality disorders, they can still know what they're doing, they can make reasonable decisions, if they commit crimes, we feel they ought to be held responsible for them. That's our point.
Interesting.
Well, a question I've had is, some of the people that you're talking about that you say you shouldn't necessarily get, and then you get this person, let's say because of an alcohol problem, well, people, if they're stipulating 86% of those cases, what can you do about that? I mean, they just give them to you, and you may not think you should have them, but you got them.
I think if the definition is modified, as we've been discussing, this will influence the judges and the stipulations and what happens at the level. We hope that we will not be patients.
One more question. Did you say you get people who are mentally retarded?
Yes. It says mental disease and mental defect.
Was that a group that you believed you should continue to get, or you're trying to exclude?
I think that's an appropriate group for us to retain jurisdiction over, because these people really cannot help themselves. They can't learn to conduct themselves in a socially acceptable manner without special training. Sometimes it takes years and years in program.
One more question. As far as the the personality disorders that you were suggesting be excluded, while there may be disagreement as to whether it's considered mental disease or defect, is it clear to all in the field what behaviors are personality disorders and what are not?
I think so. I mean, cases that we discussed, we have big, thick files. I think that the amount of disagreement that occurs between mental health and bias is sometimes caricature. Actually, the disagreement is not that great. Usually, it's pretty clear what's wrong with somebody. People sometimes change, they become actively psychotic, they have a remission, they get better, they get worse. But I think that most of the staff at OSH and people from the outside tend to see things essentially the same way. Personality disorders are a known psychiatric attribute defined in this diagnostic manual and the diagnosis.
Thank you.
We appreciate the time you've taken to this point in assisting us to analyze the measures. Of course, we are counting on the board for that kind of assistance as we work our way through these proposals. We will be returning to the bills on Friday for at least initial efforts at reaching some decisions on the subcommittee, and I hope some number of you will be able to be here with us to...
Mr. Chairman, I certainly will, but the board is going to be here
Friday.
Right.
We meet every Friday.
Thank you very much for your time. Dr. Bloom.
This letter will pretty much summarize my testimony. I think I'll just briefly go through it and highlight some points for you. Just by way of introduction, I'm a teacher at the medical school. I'm a professor in the Department of Psychiatry, and I'm also a board-certified forensic psychiatrist, and I've participated in about 1,000 cases in which we have addressed the insanity defense in these cases. And so I have what I would consider to be a practical experience with the workings of this area in the courtroom, and I've also, as you know, participated in a number of the papers that Jeff Rogers gave you last time, studying the effects, studying the people committed to the Psychiatric Review Board here, and looking at the literature developing on a national scene. I've also been involved in studies of involuntary commitment, and I think that's something I'll mention a little bit later, but I think that's important to at least note when we talk about the insanity defense and issues involved in the insanity defense. Just one other thing. Last legislature, I was the chair of a subcommittee of the governor's task force that did the sunset review of the PSRB for the legislature, and so I participated in many, many, many hours in which we reviewed the functioning of that board, because it was a sunset provision for 2 years ago, and we basically summarized our views in a rather lengthy document, which you might want to pull out if you have any questions about the functioning of the board itself. Just one other thing, I am representing myself in this testimony and the views of the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Our legislative committee has discussed these three bills in some detail and has authorized me to speak for that group. A couple of general points about the insanity defense, as it is called. I personally regard the insanity defense as a legal and not a medical issue. We did not invent it. Physicians, psychiatrists did not invent the insanity defense. It basically serves a legal function, and in many ways I believe it serves a function that's symbolic in the criminal law, in that, as you know, there are very, very few successful insanity defenses compared to the number of criminal prosecutions. But I think the insanity defense in some perverse way makes it okay for whatever else we do to people in the criminal justice system, because we've given them a small little piece of leeway in one area. The insanity defense has a history that goes back, again, as you know, many, many, many centuries. And whether the current moves to abolish the insanity defense will be found constitutional will be seen as these bills, as these laws in Idaho and Montana come to appeals courts. But it has, from my point of view, been a central area within the law, and certainly an area of controversy and an area that's done us probably more harm than good in the field of psychiatry. As a legal issue, why are we here testifying today? Well, I think the main reason that we're here and why the Oregon Psychiatric Association is interested in this area is the clientele who are found not guilty by reason of insanity, or not responsible, as it's called here in Oregon. As you know from our studies, we have found, and this is pretty much characteristic of other studies around the country, that this population, the population of persons found not responsible, is a very, very significantly mentally disordered population. We have, in our statistics, found over 75% of the people suffer from very serious mental disorders and mental defect. The majority of those persons are suffering from schizophrenia, which is a major psychotic disorder and probably the number one public health, mental health problem in the country today. To come back to the area of civil commitment just very briefly, we're living in an era of deinstitutionalization, and I'm sure you have experience with that from some of your other work in the legislature. This term describes the emptying of the mental hospitals in favor of community care, and community care has frankly been a mixed blessing for a number of mentally ill people, in that there are many, many people living in very marginal circumstances in mental health ghettos, and we have those mental health ghettos in Oregon. You know that in 1958 there were over 5,000 people in mental hospitals in Oregon, and currently there are less than 800. There's been an increasing focus in the psychiatric literature on the association of mental illness and criminal behavior, and we have found that many of the people with serious mental disorders have an increased rate of criminal-type behavior, and this is most likely due to the circumstances, to their living circumstances. What this means is that generally we found that when civil commitment rates go down, criminal confinements go up. So you're dealing with a dynamic balance between the civil side and the criminal side, and you're also dealing with a dynamic balance between the civil side and the prisons. And I think you have to think of these three areas as management areas of certain types of individuals with certain types of problems. And it seems to be most true that the mental health system can manage the mentally ill better, a lot better, than the criminal justice system can or the correction system. Now, the Psychiatric Security Review Board is a board that has managed a very, very seriously disturbed population. I don't think too many people will dispute the fact that it has worked well and has become a model both in the federal system and for other states, and that there are a number of states that are now looking to create the kind of system that we have here. My own personal view of the current status of what we need to do is that we need to do some fine-tuning at most, and radical changes would be, from my point of view, the least desirable. The PSRB system allows for the segregation of a very serious